I was looking through a list recently of some book titles that have come out. And, you know, sometimes I look for keywords, sometimes I look for interesting topics, and sometimes a title just jumps out at me. And when I saw The Hacking of the American Mind, I had to know more about that book. So I've invited the author to talk about it here today. His name is Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a pediatric endocrinologist and the author of the book here on the Big 550 KTRS. Doctor, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Harris. Appreciate it.
A pediatric endocrinologist means what?
I take care of children with hormone problems. Most recently, that has really gravitated toward taking care of obese children. And as you know, their children now get the diseases of aging without aging. They get type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. Those are also the diseases of alcohol. But they don't drink alcohol. And so I've been thrust into the fray to try to figure out what's going on and what to do about it.
And this is a recent phenomenon, last 5-10 years or longer than that?
Well, we had never seen children with type 2 diabetes until approximately 1980. And the same with fatty liver disease. It wasn't even a diagnosis until 1980. So this is really approximated the increase in obesity and also the advent of processed food in our diet, which started really in the late 70s.
Does it come down to one word, sugar?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that.
I know you wrote a whole book about it, but is that the base problem?
Well, it comes down to two words, processed food. Mm. So real food is low sugar, high fiber. Processed food is high sugar, low fiber. So high sugar for palatability, low fiber for shelf life. Those two together have created a metabolic tsunami that has overtaken our entire healthcare system and now also our Social Security system and actually is contributing to both the addiction and the depression crises in this country as well.
Who's responsible for this? Are we just bad at eating, or is your book is called The Hacking of the American Mind. Makes it sound like somebody else did something to us.
Indeed, they did. So the argument in the book is that we have two different pathways in our brain that we have misinterpreted and confused together. And the question is, how did this happen? In the book, I differentiate two positive emotions, pleasure and happiness. So people say, I don't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing they usually come up with is that pleasure is short-term and happiness is long-term. That's true, but there are six more. Pleasure is visceral, that is, you feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal, you feel it above the neck. Pleasure is taking, happiness is giving. Pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Pleasure is achievable with substances. Happiness is not achievable with substances. The extremes of pleasure, whether they be substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors like shopping, gambling, video games, social media, porn, all end up leading to addiction. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And finally, number 7, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. So two different biochemicals, two different areas of the brain, two different receptor mechanisms, two different ways that they act. So you say to me, like, so what? You have to understand what's going on in order to be able to turn it around.
Yep.
So dopamine is an excitatory neurotransmitter. What does that mean? It means that when it's released, it causes the next neuron to fire. Now, neurons like to be excited. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of a neuron leads to neuronal cell death, the death of that neuron. And so neurons have a fail-safe. They have a plan B. They have a self-defense mechanism. What they do is they downregulate the number of receptors so that that dopamine can't do as much damage. So what does this mean in human terms? It means you get a hit, you get a rush, the receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush, the receptors go down, and then a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit until finally a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons actually start to die, that's called addiction. And you can become addicted to any of those substances that cause dopamine to be released.
Okay, let me just stop you for a second. Is this the same reason that an obese person who might have once been able to get everything they needed from one pint of ice cream now has to eat two or three?
And, well, usually it's one cup of ice cream, and now they need two or three pints. Yes, that's exactly why.
Okay.
Because they have fewer receptors to be able to transduce the pleasure signal. But they've been told by the companies that sell that ice cream that that ice cream will bring them happiness.
Okay, so now we're getting to the who. And you say in your book, marketing, media, and technology have capitalized on subverting our brain physiology to their advantage in order to veer us away from the pursuit of happiness and of the pursuit of pleasure, which for them, of course, equals the pursuit of money.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So everything that causes reward, everything that causes dopamine release, costs something. So if it's a substance, you've got to pay for it. If it's a behavior, you also have to pay for it. Bottom line, happiness is free. Because happiness is not dopamine. Happiness is serotonin. And serotonin, turns out, is not an excitatory neurotransmitter. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It makes the next neuron go to rest. So you can't overdose. You can't kill that neuron. So you don't downregulate the receptor. So you can't overdose on too much happiness. But it turns out there's one thing that downregulates serotonin, dopamine. So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get.
Mm.
And Washington, Las Vegas, Madison Avenue, Silicon Valley, and Wall Street have all confused and conflated those two concepts, pleasure and happiness, together, telling you you can buy happiness. You can't. And the fact is, the more happiness, and I put that in quotes now, you buy, the more unhappy you get, the more addicted and the more depressed. And now we have the data on the smoking gun on why that happens and who's done it.
Okay, so now we know the what and we know the who. Tell me the how. How has the, let's say, the food we eat, not the junk food, but the regular food in our regular diet, how has that changed over the decades? How have things like cell phones, et cetera?
All the above. So from the food standpoint, in the 1970s, we were all told to go low fat.
Yep.
And we did. And guess what? We got sicker. So back in the 1970s, we were told dietary fat led to heart disease. That has now been completely and totally disproven. Trans fats cause heart disease. And they were putting trans fats in all of the baked goods. So anywhere you saw partially hydrogenated, you know, that truly was consumable poison. No argument.
Mm-hmm.
But those are gone away. Thing was, we were told saturated fat caused it. Turns out saturated fat is cardiovascularly neutral. But when you take the fat out of the food, it tastes like cardboard. The food industry knew that. So what'd they do? They had to make the food palatable, added the sugar. Turns out sugar, because of its effects on triglycerides, turned out to be more dangerous in terms of heart disease than the dietary fat ever was. In addition, because of the fact that only the liver can metabolize the sweet molecule in sugar called fructose, we ended up with this thing called fatty liver disease. And now, because of fatty liver disease, we have high insulin levels and all of these other chronic metabolic diseases, such as type 2 diabetes, hypertension, stroke, cancer, dementia, are all because of the high insulin levels due to the fatty liver. And we've now demonstrated that when you reverse that fatty liver, all the diseases just melt away.
Now, is this true globally, or is it particularly a purely American phenomenon?
No. This is going on in every country, developed and developing. It's just that it has happened to us first and at a higher rate because we have had the most sugar added to our diet. So when we went low fat, and we went low fat before the rest of the world, we basically started ourselves on this inevitable path to, medical destruction. And the goal is to try to reverse the ship, right the ship, and get things back to where they should be. And the only way to do that is to stop the processed food epidemic. The problem is we like our processed food because it's sugar-laden. In fact, because sugar is addictive, because the food industry took an item that they knew would get them to sell more because we buy more and eat more, and that's their juggernaut, that's their gravy train. Before the advent of the low-fat diet, the food industry made, on average, 1% per year profit margin. Well, the population increased by 1% per year. In other words, the food industry sold the same amount of food per person to more people.
Mm-hmm.
After 1975, the food industry's profit margin has increased to 5% per year. But, in fact, population rates have gone down. The increase has gone down.
Mm.
So that means they are selling way more food to fewer people. And the way they do it is because the food is now addictive.
Okay, but this is not all about food. Your book is called The Hacking of the American Mind, and I mentioned cell phones a moment ago, and I heard you go, mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. We have all these devices, our smartphones, our laptops, all the rest of it, that are supposedly making our lives easier and better. Are they?
You tell me. We have an epidemic of teenage depression and suicide. In fact, in the 10 to 14-year-old age group, suicide has now overtaken motor vehicle accidents as the primary cause of death.
Mm.
Do you think that's saying that things are okay?
No, not at all.
All right? So this is an example. We also now have these phenomena called social media addiction, video game addiction. In boys, it's video games. In girls, it's social media, which are causing an enormous amount of distress and ultimately depression. And the reason is because that like button on Facebook, that's a dopamine hit every time you hit it.
Yep.
And and this has been engineered in. You could say, well, the like button, that's obvious. But do you use Gmail, Paul?
No, I don't.
Well, if you ever use Gmail, your listeners I'm sure do, you would notice that when you click on new emails, there's a 1.5 to 2 second delay before the new emails populate your cell phone. You think Google's just slow?
No.
That's been engineered in. That's been baked into the program. And the reason we know that is because Tristan Harris, former Google executive who designed it, outed the company and actually left the company because of their addictive nature, and has actually set up a nonprofit to try to combat it because he's gotten religion.
What does that one-second pause do?
It gives you a dopamine hit to your nucleus accumbens, your reward center, okay, in an attempt to try to keep you addicted.
Mm.
Sean Parker, who was one of the founders of Facebook along with Mark Zuckerberg, you remember him, Napster?
Yep.
Facebook, you remember the social media
network
movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is now on record to the New York Times saying that they designed Facebook to be addictive. Indeed, we have it in their own words. We have the smoking gun.
And in addition to the addiction, it's doing something horrible to our attention spans, isn't it?
Indeed. So part of the issue of whether or not the ADD, the attention deficit disorder epidemic that we now see amongst children and teenagers, whether this might be due to technology and screens, is being investigated. My colleagues here at UCSF are actually trying to figure out ways to use video games to try to treat ADD. My colleagues Adam Ghazali and Alyssa Marco are trying to figure out how to beat the video game industry at their own game.
Hmm.
So this is a perennial and a well-thought-out and an organized, I won't call it conspiracy, because conspiracy would require collusion between industry actors, which we do not see. We don't have data for that. But it is definitely a plot, because every industry has figured out, every corporation has figured out how to sell their product.
I'll bet your colleagues don't have as much money for their research as the video game industry does for its.
And so we are always playing catch-up. You know, the public health profession does not have the money the food industry does. And, of course, my colleagues don't have as much money as the technology companies do, and so we are in the position of trying to mitigate the harms to public health on a shoestring. That's the reason I wrote the book, is to get the information out there so people can know what's being done to them.
You mentioned earlier that there's a drug element to this as well, and we, of course, have a gigantic opioid crisis in this country now. It goes back, you know, several years to fentanyl and all the rest. The history has been already well written, and the people have been well exploited and continue to be. But in addition to opioids, we have an enormous number of people in this country who are on medications like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil and all the rest.
Right.
Do all those people actually need those drugs? Did we get better at diagnosing them, or was this big pharma hacking our minds again?
Well, so here's the problem. We have two different phenomena. We have something called clinical depression, which has been with us for a long time.
Yep.
Clinical depression is part of the human condition, and it's been around for millennia. And those people are suicidal, and those people, if they don't take medication to up their serotonin levels in their brain, they're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always been there. But now, in the last 40 years, we have a new phenomenon, which we have a name for. It's called atypical depression. It doesn't actually meet all the criteria of clinical depression, which is, for instance, one example of how it doesn't meet it is that in clinical depression, you stop eating. You have no interest in eating. We have actually increased our interest in eating.
Mm.
And in the process have gotten more and more unhappy. And the reason is because our food has actually depleted our serotonin. So we can't get happy eating this processed food diet. We get bolts of pleasure from dopamine, from the sugar that's been put into processed food, but we have all become highly dysphoric, is the word. What we call atypical depression, which is not, you know, different from clinical depression, but a lot of these people are being treated with SSRIs anyway. The question is there a better way? And the answer is absolutely. There are ways to increase your serotonin and tamp down your dopamine. And believe it or not, they're all free. They're all evidence-based. They're all clinically proven to work. And they're all free. They're all things your mother told you. And the problem is you forgot because you were busy checking your cell phone while drinking a Coca-Cola.
I'm going to guess that it comes down to four words: eat less, exercise more.
No.
Oh.
A different four words, but those aren't the four words. Four words. What I call the four C's. They're in the book. Number one, connect. Now, that does not mean Facebook. Connect means interpersonal, face-to-face, eye-to-eye interaction.
Mm-hmm.
In someone's presence. And that has to be, it has to be with person in their presence, because you have a set of neurons in the back of your head called mirror neurons that transduce the signals of facial expressions that the person you're talking to transmits to you. You read those in real time, and those mirror neurons adopt the emotions that you see on the other person's face. This is the process that we generally call empathy. And empathy is a specific driver of serotonin. Problem is, Facebook ain't no interaction.
Mm.
It's connectivity without connection.
Right.
Okay. Same thing with Anonymous. Okay. You cannot have a relationship with Anonymous. Can't be done.
Yep.
Okay. So this is the problem with our current digital connection. It does not satisfy definition of connection.
Okay, what?
Connectivity without connection.
What's the next C?
Contribute. And that does not mean to your IRA. That does not mean for Boy Scout badges. Okay? This means contributing to the outside world, whether it be your friends, your family, the world at large, with no specific fit to yourself. Okay? In the form of volunteerism, altruism, philanthropy. The that contribute from your work? And the answer is yes, you can, with two provisos. Number one, you can see how your work affects others. And number two, your boss can see it too. If both of those are satisfied, then you can derive contribution and therefore contentment from your work.
Okay.
Number three, cope. And for cope, I mean three specific things: sleep, mindfulness, and exercise. Turns out 35% of adults do not get 7 hours of sleep per night, and 23% are insomniacs. And when you don't get enough sleep, your cortisol goes hog wild. That actually suppresses the part of your brain that inhibits dopamine, and so your dopamine goes hog wild and your serotonin falls to zero. So you got to get enough sleep. Problem is, our new digital culture actually prevents sleep. So kids who charge their cell phones in their room get 28 minutes less sleep per night than kids that charge their cell phones outside their room.
Hmm.
And it's not because they're on the cell phones, it's because of the blue light. It's keeping them awake.
Interesting.
Okay. Second, mindfulness. So the most common buzzword amongst corporate America today is multitasking.
Yep.
Everybody has to be a multitasker. Turns out 2.5% of the population can actually multitask. Everyone else is serial unitasking. And when you do that, every time you change tasks, you get a cortisol bump, which only disinhibits you and makes you even more miserable.
Mm.
So the concept of mindfulness in order to combat this, overwhelming phenomenon of multitasking is essential. And then finally, exercise. Turns out exercise is better at alleviating depression than SSRIs are. And then finally, number four, the last C, cook. Turns out there are three items in food, three specific chemicals in food that either raise your serotonin or tamp down your dopamine. The two that raise serotonin are tryptophan, which is the precursor to tryptophan, which you find in egg, poultry, fish. They're not the processed food. And omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory and increase serotonin transmission as well. That's real food. We're talking omega-3s, tryptophan.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that downs your serotonin by upping your dopamine, fructose. That's sugar. So a low tryptophan, low omega-3, high fructose diet, that's called processed food. A high tryptophan, high omega-3, low fructose diet, that's called real food. Problem is, you have to cook real food.
Yep.
So if you sit down to a meal with your family and your friends that you've cooked, you are connecting, you are contributing, you are coping, and you are cooking.
Mm-hmm.
It's the single best thing you can do for yourself to increase yours and everyone's around you, your happiness.
This is all great advice from Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist and a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as the author of a terrific new book called The Hacking of the American Mind. Congratulations on all your work. I hope people get your message, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.